From Alaska to Florida, Hawaii to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, climate change may be a big issue in Washington, D.C., but a new poll from the Competitive Enterprise Institute finds it is not a top concern for most Americans. Myron Ebell of CEI is here with details. Congressional Democrats have still not been able to strike an agreement on the size and scope of the president's so-called Build Back Better agenda. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The supply chain crisis is real, and government intervention into the free market is making the situation worse. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Brian Riley of the National Taxpayers Union. And congressional Democrats push through a major pro-abortion bill that is at odds with both religious teachings and our national heritage. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Climate change is driving national energy and fiscal policy, but most Americans are more concerned about the economy, illegal immigration, and other issues. A new poll by the Competitive Enterprise Institute finds an unwillingness to pay for the left's policy prescriptions for dealing with climate change. Joining us with details is Myron Ebell. He is director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Myron, welcome to American Radio Journal. Myron, you have this CEI poll on energy and environment. Tell us a little bit about the poll. Why did CEI undertake it, and what were you seeking to learn?
We did a similar poll last spring, and this is a follow-up. The purpose is to track what Americans are thinking about some of the policies being proposed by the Biden-Harris administration and by Democrats in Congress, particularly to raise energy prices, to change our electric grid, to change the kind of vehicles that we can drive and what choices we have in terms of buying cars and trucks. And we also wanted to ask how much people are willing to spend for this new order of things with climate, as President Biden said. We're now, everything is about climate. It's an existential crisis, and we have to, in everything that we do, we have to address it. So we're looking to see what people are actually think about that and how much they're willing to spend.
As an overall takeaway from the poll, just in looking at these various numbers, it would appear to me, Myron, that the general public is not agreeing with the president and the left that this is an existential crisis and don't seem to be willing to make the changes that the left is prescribing.
Yes, and we found this last spring as well, and I think if you look at other polls that other groups have done, or even the Washington Post or Gallup, you'll see similar responses. That is, first of all, Americans are concerned about climate change. They say that they are. 75% or 70% Americans say that they're either somewhat or very concerned about climate change. But then when you drill down about what kind of lifestyle changes or what kind of costs, They pretty quickly pull back and say, well, you know, compared to some other things I'm concerned about, I'm not really that concerned about climate change. So I think it's become politically correct for everybody to just say that they're concerned about climate. But when asked in our poll, and Gallup gets the same response, asked about, well, rate this compared to other issues that you're concerned about, it doesn't come up very high. In a list of 10 or 12, it's about the eighth highest priority that people give. So it's not high compared to some of the other major issues facing the country.
It does seem, in reading the results of your poll, Myron, that the economy and jobs, immigration, crime, energy prices all rate ahead of climate change. So let's take a look at a couple of the particularly policy prescriptions that the Biden administration is proposing. And first of all, they want to do away completely, even if that were realistic, they want to do away completely with the production of gas and diesel-powered cars and trucks. Are people going along with that?
No. And I think there are a lot of people who are interested in buying electric vehicles. But when asked whether they think that they should not have a choice between a gas-powered vehicle and an electric vehicle. The overwhelming majority of people think that they should get to decide, not the government, and not the government working in collusion with the automakers to just get rid of gas and diesel. So I think there's a very strong majority here that just say, no, I need that choice myself. I may want to buy an electric vehicle, especially if it gets a big federal subsidy, as it currently does. But I want to make that decision myself.
Even with the federal subsidies, electric-powered vehicles are more expensive. Are people willing to pay more to get an electric-powered vehicle?
Well, some people are. I think this can change over time as people see that there are more charging stations and that the price of electricity remains low. But if the price of electricity goes up, because that's what the federal policy is being pursued by the Biden-Harris administration, if the price of electricity goes up the way it has done in California, which is now twice the national average, I think people are going to be less willing to pay more for an electric vehicle because they'll never get it back in savings versus gasoline. So right now, it's cheaper, right? It's cheaper even in California to go fill up your Tesla with electricity than it is to buy $4 or $5 a gallon gasoline in California, which is what they have there. But the federal policies are really designed to make electric rates go up a lot, and I think that will make electric vehicles they'll have to subsidize them even more to get people to buy them.
Interesting that your poll showed that 4 out of 10 individuals wouldn't spend even $1 to affect climate change. They're also not willing to dip into their savings, whether it be for education or retirement either, or at least most of them are not, correct?
Yes, and we ask this question, and other groups have asked this question going back a long time, how much more are you willing to spend, you personally or your family? And there's a very large contingent, about 40% of the population, that just says zero. But it doesn't take very much. Our poll found that you get well over 50% of Americans are willing to spend $50 or less per year on climate policy. Well, I think a lot of Americans are not aware that in some states you're already spending a lot more than that, right? California, as I said, has pursued policies which are raising electric rates and gas prices, and people are spending hundreds of dollars more per year on behalf of the climate already. So I think if you're from a state that doesn't have all these climate policies, you're in good shape here. But when you say you're not willing to spend any more, if you come from one of these heavily Democratic states, New York, California, New England, you're already spending several hundred dollars on climate.
We are talking with Myron Ebell, director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. They have recently conducted a poll on energy and environmental issues. Myron, if we have listeners who would like to read more about this issue, read the results of the poll, tell us where they can find that information and tell us a bit about the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Our website is CEI.org, CEI.org. CEI is a small, nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy institute. We specialize in regulatory issues, red tape, and the kind of regulations that slow down our economic activity. So we don't work just on energy and environment. We work on a wide range of regulations and what they do, what the unintended consequences of those regulations is.
Myron Ebell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Myron, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth joins us every week to give us an update on what's happening in Capitol Hill. Also, we take a look at political races around the country. Today, however, a lot of, I won't say action on Capitol Hill, but a lot of talk and negotiating. So, Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
We are approaching the end of October and Halloween. Scott, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has pledged to have some grand things done by Halloween. As of this recording, it not quite getting over the finish line. So tell us a bit about the process that they're trying to use in Congress, and then we're going to go into where things stand with both that infrastructure bill and the so-called Build Back Better bill.
Well, the bottom line is this should be pretty spooky for all the listeners out there. Democrats continue to try to find a way forward through private negotiations, not any sort of transparent negotiations that we're seeing unfold within the legislative process on a floor of the House of Representatives or the United States Senate. So instead, you've got top negotiators from the White House working in concert, really, with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to try to see what Joe Manchin's willing to stomach within the United States Senate with Kyrsten Sinema, and then what those radical progressives in the House of Representatives alongside the Progressive Caucus with Congresswoman Jayapal are willing to go for. And so this week, we really saw Joe Biden double down and come to Capitol Hill on Thursday and talk to these members about different concessions that he was willing to make in order to pare back the $3.5 trillion effort to slightly under $2 trillion. Now, I think the listeners that have been paying attention for the last several months to the negotiations remember that $3.5 trillion is on top of the $1.9 trillion that we did for the Biden stimulus earlier this year. It's on top of all that spending that we did with the coronavirus pandemic relief underneath the final year of President Donald Trump. And so now Democrats are really trying to change the social structure of our economy, and they're doing that in a big way through this framework that was announced this week. I think that the progressives are still very, very skeptical that this is big enough and bold enough for the Build Back Better Biden framework, but there are a few key provisions that have certainly fallen off of the negotiating table just in the last day or so. And what we're seeing right now is, for example, the original bill was going to expand Medicare to cover dental, vision, and hearing, and that's a provision that's fallen out. When the Democrats talk about having this bill be paid for, of course, they've got all sorts of budgetary gimmicks in order to do that. One of the big gimmicks that I think is within the current framework is a $400 billion revenue raiser through so-called IRS investment to close the tax gap. Now, what that means is that they're going to build up and grow the Internal Revenue Service to focus on those that they believe are cheating the tax code. At the beginning of the week, we heard about this proposal to tax billionaires on unrealized capital gains. And the problem with that is, if let's say that you've got a big investment and this investment has grown from $1 million to $7 million, and they're going to tax you on that $6 million gain. Well, what if you haven't sold it and then it goes down to $500,000 and all of a sudden you've already paid taxes on $6 million that you never actually earned through any sort of capital gains income? So I think it's a real issue, and I actually don't think that capital gains is income at all. I think that it's investment. And so whether or not that proposal was constitutional was debated this week on Capitol Hill. There were rumors that the proposal was off the table and then it was back on the table. And I hope that the underlying theme of my comments today to the listeners is that everything is very, very chaotic right now in Washington. Joe Biden's entire agenda is slipping through his fingers. Nancy Pelosi's power that she's historically had over her Democratic caucus for really a generation is starting to break. And we're seeing new levers of power jump up. And, you know, I think that Jayapal is certainly one of them, holding the Progressive Caucus in line. And then you've obviously got the Socialist Squad with AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley. The four of them are really flexing their own political grit. And, you know, I think that's what's drawing a lot of these concessions and extending things. On the other hand, Joe Manchin in the United States Senate is so far holding strong, to his credit. A lot of Republicans have said, hey, Joe, you really should become a Republican because the Democratic Party that you once belonged to is so far gone. And when you think about voting behavior across America, a lot of folks are waking up to that fact. And next week on Tuesday, we're going to be having a massive election here in Virginia with Glenn Youngkin taking on Terry McAuliffe for the governor's race. And I think that what the status is of the so-called Build Back Better Biden reconciliation bill, along with the bipartisan infrastructure legislation that's hanging out there, whether this stuff can get done, I don't think that it'll get done while Joe Biden is in Europe, but look, I've been wrong before, but right now it just seems like the Republicans are sitting on the sidelines and basically giddy over this idea that Democrats are completely split.
Does all of this have an impact on that very critical governor's race in Virginia, Scott? Because most recent polls have that race essentially a dead heat. Is this going to be something that's going to be depressing to Democrat voters, that they have control, albeit by very narrow margins in the House and even Senate, but they haven't been able to get their act together? So is this something where Democrat voters might say, hey, what's the point? I'm going to just stay home.
Pun intended, what's the point? It could be a one-point race in this governor's race. It's going to be incredibly tight. Right now, I think both sides are trying to project an image of being in the lead, but Terry McAuliffe had an event in the middle of the day this week that only had 14 people at it. I mean, what kind of momentum is behind a candidate when you can only get 14 people to show up an event, even if it's during the middle of the day in the final week of a campaign? So, on the other hand, Glenn Youngkin has declined having top Republican surrogates come into Virginia. He's focused on his own campaign, his own messaging, without bringing in the star-studded talent within the Republican bench. And so voter enthusiasm is a real question. I think that a lot of Democrats will be disheartened if nothing gets done in advance of Tuesday, but also if they go ahead and somehow miraculously are able to accommodate an agreement by Tuesday, maybe there will be momentum from the Republican side.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our organization is united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. And if anybody wants to learn more about the core issues that we advocate on behalf of our members, check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Government intervention into the marketplace is making the nation's supply chain crisis even worse. That's what Brian Riley of the National Taxpayers Union tells Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Everything from your Halloween candy to your Christmas presents could be getting tied up in this supply chain meltdown that's going on all over the country right now. But can the government really fix this problem, or will intervention only make it worse? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Brian Riley. He is the director of the Free Trade Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. And he's one of the guys in D.C. who I turn to whenever I am confused about what's happening in the economy and with trade and all of that. And I've been confused a lot lately. So really glad to have him here on the show, I think, for the first time. Brian, thanks for taking some time and joining.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to get into a piece that you wrote that folks can find at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation blog, that's ntu.org, about the sugar program and subsidies for sugar. But before we get into that, I want to start with this sort of general supply chain problem that we're seeing right now, in particular on the West Coast, but I guess it's really a national issue at this point. It's going to affect, I think, a lot of Americans when they go Christmas shopping or just go to the grocery store. And it seems like, I mean, the White House has clearly acknowledged this problem in the last couple of weeks. We've seen them like put some pressure on these ports to start operating 24/7. We've seen them try to do some other things. Now they're threatening fines for empty shipping containers, things like that. It seems like there's really limited political options here, though.
Yeah, it's not easy. And I think the first thing to do is to really attempt to accurately diagnose the problem. We do have supply chain issues. There's no doubt about that. Some people call it a crisis. I don't necessarily agree that it's a crisis. To me, that's just an excuse sometimes to necessitate government intervention and often making things worse. But they're legitimate problems. But think about why we're having these problems in 2021, and we didn't have them so much in the past. I mean, we would have occasional blips here and there. I think a lot of it is due to the COVID pandemic, and either the pandemic itself or to the actions that governments have taken in response to COVID, which have made it tougher to get goods from point A to point B. And at the same time, here in the United States, dumped a lot of money into the economy, and that's created more demand for products. And those have kind of combined to create a lot of the problems. And so the root cause of this, in my opinion, is largely the ongoing issues with the pandemic and the government response, however you want to allocate blame there. So it's good that we're looking at some of the other issues. How long does it take to get our cargo unloaded and to get it across the country and everything else? Those are always going to be important issues, but we've got to look at the root cause of the problem as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, and many root causes, as you said, I mean, things, everything from, you know, increased demand because people have so much more money in their pockets right now to worker shortages and on and on. One thing you mentioned in there, though, is that like government intervention frequently makes these issues worse. And that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about the sugar program, because I think this is a great example, kind of the small example that tells the bigger story here. Americans pay, what, close to twice what people in other countries do for sugar, and that's because of policy. That's not because, like, it costs more to import sugar into the U.S. or something.
It is 100% policy-driven. You're correct about that. We actually pay more than twice the world price for sugar. That changes from year to year as domestic and world prices fluctuate, of course, but it's cost us over $6 billion in higher sugar prices last year. You know, as we head into the most popular candy-consuming holiday of the year, Halloween, I think it's a good time to think about the sugar program. And if you look at just, you go down a list of whether it's, we're going to make Americans pay twice the world price for sugar, we're going to have tariffs on steel, we're going to restrict aluminum imports, we're going to put tariffs on fertilizer, all these things that make it harder for Americans to get the goods that we need, and then a lot of times problems that are blamed on supply chains. Well, if the government would just get out of the way and remove some barriers, it wouldn't be a miracle cure-all, but it would sure be a step in the right direction. I think the sugar program is a perfect example of that, not only in terms of something we should get rid of, but at a minimum, let's not repeat that mistake in other sectors of the economy.
We're talking with Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation, talking about these restrictions and sort of government policies that foul up the supply chains. And Brian, just about a minute or so left here, but I mean, this is a lesson that we could apply. I mean, you mentioned tariffs and some other things. This is a lesson that I think you could also look at with like electric vehicles and issues like that, right? Where we have kind of a government policy that says, well, we want more of these things. But then at the same time, we have other government policies that make it difficult to get the things we need to make them.
Right, or in the Build Back Better bill, we want more EVs, but we only want them if they're made in the United States. Oh, and we only want them if they're made by union workers, so that, which undermines the very goal in the first place of having cleaner environment and more EVs. They are inherently contradictory policies. Looking at it rationally, of course, politically, there are good reasons for it. In one sense, unions are such big supporters of the Biden administration and Democrats in general that they're going to bend over backwards to take care of them, even if that really creates other problems in other areas of the economy. You know, particularly for environmental goods, I'd like to see us get rid of tariffs and restrictions so that if we can get solar goods from Japan or Germany, and whether they're vehicles or turbines for wind or whatever, remove barriers instead of saying, no, everything's going to be made in the United States, which just slows things down and slows progress.
Yeah, so whether it's Halloween candy or solar panels for your roof or a battery for your electric car, all of these things sort of responsible for sort of the product of global free trade. We are unfortunately out of time for today. That is Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Brian, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to Brian as well, and happy Halloween to all of you out there. You can check out Brian's work at ntu.org and check out everything I'm working on as well at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congressional Democrats have passed a radical pro-abortion bill. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A week after Pope Francis yet again referred to abortion as murder, that is, in his words, akin to hiring a hitman, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, a lifetime professing Roman Catholic, put forward a bill that the Catholic bishops called, quote, the most radical abortion bill of all time. Pelosi's bishop in San Francisco, Archbishop Salvatore Cordellone, described the bill as nothing short of child sacrifice. The proposed legislation was given a typical Orwellian name, the Women's Health Protection Act of 2021. The very name was condemned by Pelosi's bishops. Archbishop Joseph Nauman, chair of the bishop's pro-life committee, denounced the, quote, deceptively named extreme bill that would impose abortion on demand nationwide at any stage of pregnancy through federal statute, unquote. Indeed, the bill seeks to create a national statutory right to abortion, attempting to nationalize all abortion laws. It aims to override countless state-based rules and limitations, such as waiting periods, ultrasounds, and limits on late-term abortions. As Bishop Cordeleon notes, it's a particularly heinous piece of legislation. Nonetheless, Nancy Pelosi threw the whole weight of her party behind it. Introduced by Pelosi's California colleague, Representative Judy Chu, it passed the House on a strict party-line vote, 218 to 211. Every Democrat but one voted for it. Not one Republican, by contrast, voted for it. It was a huge victory for Nancy Pelosi. She called it a very exciting day for some of us in Congress. Pelosi celebrated, whereas her bishop most certainly did not. Said Archbishop Cordeleon, quote, any reasonable person with a basic sense of morality and inkling of decency cannot but shudder in horror at such a heinous evil being codified in law. He said it was especially shameful that any self-professed Catholic would be implicated in such an evil, let alone advocate for it. And yet, Nancy Pelosi did that, and then some. Asked about her advocacy of such an evil by EWTN News Nightly correspondent Eric Rosales, Pelosi, as she often does in these moments, did not hesitate to invoke a theological explanation. She said, quote, well, the Archbishop of the city of that area of San Francisco and I have a disagreement about who should decide this. And I believe that God has given us a free will to honor our responsibilities, unquote. Well, of course, Pelosi's right there. God has given us a free will. However, explicitly not to be used in this way. Deuteronomy 30:19 says, I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life. This is affirmed throughout the Old and New Testament. We are told by God, thou shalt not kill. What Pelosi affirmed is, of course, utterly contrary to how a Christian and a Catholic understands free will. The Catechism of Pelosi's church says of free will, quote, by free will, one shapes one's own life. Human freedom is a force for growth and maturity in truth and goodness. There is no true freedom except in the service of what is good and just. The choice to disobey and do evil is an abuse of freedom, unquote. Now, if all that's too religious for you, please understand that this is not only the Roman Catholic view of free will or a Christian one, but of so many of America's founding fathers and presidents. From George Washington to Woodrow Wilson to FDR to JFK to Ronald Reagan. In his farewell address, Washington, the founder of the country, cautioned that, quote, morality is a necessary spring of popular government. He said, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. That is, a nation of virtuous laws, as Washington said, needs virtuous people. We have the right to choose, yes, but we must choose well. Nancy Pelosi's notion of free will and freedom would be wholly condemned not only by her church, but by the founding fathers. It is an abuse of freedom, and sadly, she's not alone in that abuse. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KBZN-FM in Salt Lake City, Utah, WNAU-AM in New Albany, Mississippi, along with WXRQ-AM in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.